That's when I envy you, Ed, because you have someone. You have the same person every day for over 30 years. You wake up with her, you eat with her, you sleep with her, make love to the same woman. You spend every possible waking moment together. While I'm out running around with some 20-year-olds who just want to have a good time and cheap sex, 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 girls who can't say no. Girls who can't get enough. More, more, more. It's your turn now to wear the handcuffs.
After the credits roll, there's always more to tell. Especially when the video sales are doing really well. From Shock Treatment to Jason X to Police Academy 6. This is Sequel Cast. And they are unsurpassed at following the franchise until the bitter end. This is Sequel Cast, and your hosts have asked that I inform you that the show will now begin.
Hello and welcome to the Sequel Cast. The Sequel Cast is a podcast that looks at movies in a franchise one film at a time. This time around, we're looking at the second film in the Naked Gun series, The Naked Gun 2.5, The Smell of Fear, which came out in 1991 and was directed by David Zucker, who also directed the first film. I'm Matt, with me is Thrasher.
Hello, loyal listeners.
And our theme song is written and performed by Mark with a C. Check out his music at markwithac.com. And the Sequel Cast is a proud member of the Battleship Retention podcast fleet. Check out other great film and TV podcasts at battleshipretention.com. So Naked Gun 2.5. I never saw this in theaters at the time. I just saw this on video.
Same here. This is a terrible title.
Yeah, you know, we were talking about that a bit before the show, and I agree. As a kid, I was very disappointed. There was not, you never found out what the smell of fear was. I mean, it's trying to sound pulpy. The first one was just Naked Gun from the files of the police squad, which was referring to a TV show probably nobody even saw that much.
Well, only because it was only on for like a week and a half.
Right, yeah, it was only, I think the whole thing was 6 episodes, and they didn't even air all the episodes at the same time. So, it's just one of those things. I'm looking at the movie poster for this. It's just weird. It's Leslie Nielsen as Frank Drebin doing these gigantic splits, riding two bullets in the air.
Which I actually kind of like, just because I love that allude to physical comedy.
Yeah, it certainly is about physical comedy. And I was surprised looking back at the box office gross in 1991 when this came out. In the United States, this was the number 10 film of the year.
Huh.
And this theatrically, this is the most successful of the Naked Gun trilogy. So above it at number 9 was The Father of the Bride, remake with Steve Martin. And below it at 11 was Fried Green Tomatoes.
So this outperformed Fried Green Tomatoes?
Barely, but yes.
Although then again, this is probably more remembered than Fried Green Tomatoes. I think the only thing that I think Fried Green Tomatoes' legacy is the one joke about it on the Simpsons episode Apu's Wedding.
It could be. I believe Kathy Bates was in that. I think it was nominated for some Oscars or something. But yeah, on to Naked Gun. I mean,
This was a weird rewatching this movie, because I haven't seen this movie in years, but I remember really liking it, and rewatching it, I did not enjoy this movie. The parts I liked, I really, really like, and they drove me to hysterics, but they were too few and far between.
I think it gets better towards the end, but there's all that George Bush stuff in the beginning that just dates it.
Yeah. I guess they're going for a cold open, but it's a cold open without any big exciting punch like we got with the cold open for the first film.
Right. I mean, it feels, all I can do watching this with George Bush is they didn't get Dana Carvey to play George Bush, who did such a great job of playing him on SNL. And so I'm just looking at the guy, John Rourke, who's okay, but it just makes me wonder, well, gee, I'd rather just see Dana Carvey doing it.
Well, he's in such cadaverous makeup to look like George Bush. Like, I kept expecting at some point they would pull his face off and it would turn out to be a mask.
Right. Like, I don't like, he gets the sound okay, but it's not as good as you think it would be. I don't know. It's just not.
It's a flat opening. And it's also just trying to lay way too much pipe with explaining about the president's energy policy and Dr. Oppenheimer?
Meinheimer.
Dr. Meinheimer. Although I did love the gag with the lobster. I thought that was great.
The lobster was a good bit of physical comedy. But yeah, I mean, this film just takes a long time to get started. And
it's just like this podcast.
Yeah, this podcast is off to kind of a slow start as well. And I mean, you know, as the main bad guy in here is the executive Quentin Hapsburg, played by Robert Goulet,
who's fantastic.
He's good, but in some ways I think it's sort of similar to what you had with the bad guy in the first film.
Well, but I think that's good, and I think that's where things fall apart, because one of the real strengths of the first film is that everything is played completely straight. But in this second film, there's a lot less of that. Goulet is one of the few people who's playing it straight in this film.
Right. There's not as much. Yeah, there's more winking of the camera. There's less memorable scenes in this one than the first one.
More comedy voices.
Explain what you mean by comedy voices.
Well, like for instance, later on in the film, the trio of villains are all representative of the coal lobby, the fossil fuel lobby, the oil lobby, and the nuclear power lobby, and their master plan is to replace Dr. Meinheimer with a master of disguise who will deliver a phony recommendation to the president so that America will still be dependent on their fuel sources and not look into any alternative fuel sources. And when we see the master of disguise, it's like he's got this ridiculous Southern accent.
And his hair, too, looks a bit
Yeah, it has,
ridiculous.
Practically has clown hair.
Sure, and I mean, it is the same actor doing both parts. But it's not. If you're going to do a disguise, it should have been more of a dramatic, I think, change.
Well, I honestly feel like maybe they should have just gone with two different people, just to make the whole disguise that much more of a crazy thing. Because they even make a comment. He's like, "Have you noticed anything different about Dr. Meinheimer?" Well, he's a foot taller than he used to be, and like, you know, all these other things. I really wish they had played that up.
Yeah, that would have given them more to work with. One scene I did like in this is a scene in a sex toy shop. I thought it was funny.
You know, that is true. There is some comedy in that scene, and yet, like, the thing that always stands out is, you know, while they're you know, talking to their informant and like looking over what's in the sex shop, the police chief Hawken picks up this machine that's basically a like gas powered pneumatic drill with a dildo on the end. But that's an actual thing. You can get that now.
I just like there's all the stuff in the background. They don't pay that much attention to it, but then sometimes you see them sort of glare at it in the background. It adds that setting. I just thought was real enjoyable and was sort of a crazy place for them to be.
Well, there's very, like, it looks like an actual sex shop. And it is a setting that you don't really see in movies or television. There's never a scene in the sex shop.
Right, unless it's a sort of a darker cop movie or something, like what that Nicolas Cage movie, 8mm. There's a scene in a sex toy shop, but that whole movie's about sex crime investigation.
Yeah, I think the same thing happened on an episode of one of the few episodes of CSI I saw that also had an extended sequence in a sex shop, and that's something that really bothers me, that those shops are only shown in a negative light. They never show all the amazing things that come out of that shop.
I just think it's because I don't know, in the United States at least, I just don't think people like to talk about sex that much, you know, really.
Oh, they don't have to talk about it. They just have to look at it. Take a good long look.
I was kind of annoyed that they did the on-again, off-again thing with the romance in this movie.
Well, I guess they felt like they had to include a romantic arc, and I almost bought it as a bit of meta-satire on, like, for instance, like the Die Hard movies, where the beginning of every movie, he has to be on the outs with his wife.
In the first few, yeah. I mean, they sort of drop that later on, but that is a thing setting up those films, and, you know, you get a bit of their relationship rekindling with each other, which is...
Well, there's some good comedy there. I kind of wish there had been more focus on them getting back together, because some of the my favorite gags in the movie were when Leslie Nielsen and Lisa Marie were on screen.
They do have a fun sort of chemistry. I'm just not sure you needed to have her in the plot, or it's the same sort of thing that reminded me of the first film where she has a sort of relationship with the bad guy, and then like, oh, you can't suspect him. Oh, you got this right. I mean, those are similar beats. And this is a really short movie at 81 minutes.
And yet it feels longer.
It does, and I'm not sure whether it's because the plot is somewhat convoluted and takes a long time to get going, and then just when it starts to get good, the movie ends.
Well, like, the plot is too complicated, and I think too much is at stake. Like, the absurdity of Ricardo Montalban trying to assassinate Queen Elizabeth, like, that's a perfect over-the-top plot for, like, an action movie parody. But Naked Gun 2.5, a plot being based around the president's energy policy, that's like something from a political thriller from the 70s, which this movie is not attempting to parody in any way. And I guess the other thing is, I keep wondering, is this movie just full of failed political satire, or is it just poorly written? Because I keep feeling like with everything set up with the Bush administration and energy policy and things like that, that like some humorous commentary on politics is being set up, but then it doesn't go anywhere. And that's also what makes the plot so convoluted, because, you know, these lobbies, they don't need to plant a phony energy policy recommendation. They just have to do what they always do, lobby. It's not as if there was any danger of the Bush administration actually looking into alternative energy sources at this time.
It just might be a lot of the political content in this is dated. I mean, I think, you know, we're probably missing some stuff here. It doesn't help this movie is shot in a way that looks like a TV show. It just looks real flat.
Very true.
And not that the first film was some like gorgeous cinematic masterpiece, but it seemed like you had at least more locations with them running on the beach and the montage and stadium. And
they took advantage of the fact that it's a film, and I love all that baseball stadium stuff. This movie doesn't have a set piece like that.
No, at the end, it's a bit of a spoof with the ticking time bomb, which we'll get into pretty soon.
Oh, yeah.
A pretty good joke. But we're really zipping through our discussion of the film here.
Well, actually, let's talk about gags we liked and didn't like.
All right. I liked a gag near the end where they're trying to deactivate the bomb, and they clip the wrong thing, and it speeds up the timer.
Oh, yeah, as per your request. You're accelerating the countdown. I love that. Well, like, everything in that bomb scene I love. I love where apparently the bomb has massive whirling gears and it sucks off Leslie Nielsen's shirt for some reason. And then I love the way that it's an atomic weapon, isn't it?
Yes, and I think, you know, you get the ticking time bomb that makes the scene kind of exciting, and then that it's solved by him tripping over the electric cord and it stops. And you have this victorious music. It's just so ridiculous.
Yeah, I love the idea that you can unplug a nuclear device from a wall and it just shuts down. That was a fantastic gag.
What's a gag that you enjoyed?
I love the whole thing with the police sketch artist, where they look at his like sketches, and it's like it's they're all, even though he's supposed to be drawing a description of the man that Lisa Marie saw, all of his sketches are like erotic fantasy sketches. Like, the more they look through, the more over the top and more Boris Vallejo, Julie Bell they look. Until finally it's like a dominatrix with like a werewolf head, and then whatever's next in the book horrifies Ed Hawkins so much he puts the sketchbook away.
And that's nice in the last one, you never see what that final picture is, because they get progressively stranger and stranger. So just imagine it has to be something horrifying.
And actually, there's a lot of good comedy in that whole sequence, because you know, a bomb has gone off in that building, which is also, I love. I think it was Buster Keaton said an audience loves a slow thinker, and that whole thing with the bomb at the beginning of the movie is loaded with that. Where like the janitor cleaning up finds like a bundle of dynamite with a clock on it, and he brings it downstairs. Gary, would you look at this? Somebody threw away a perfectly good clock. Wow, that is a nice clock, Bill. And like, they talk about the quality of the clock for ages. But yeah, because there's an explosion, like they have like chalk outlines from where people like died, and like there are chalk outlines on the ceiling, chalk outlines on the wall. There are chalk outlines of Egyptian hieroglyphs, which I got a real big kick out of.
That is a good bit in the beginning. One bit I don't think works quite as well is near the end, as they're wrapping the movie up, you get Jane, played by Priscilla Presley, you know, marries Leslie Nielsen, and they propose. And there's a bit of physical comedy where Barbara Bush accidentally gets knocked out, and she's hanging by her underwear off the side of the building.
Yeah, it's just it doesn't provide a nice comedy cap on what's going on.
No, and I guess you're trying to think of. It's difficult to top the stuff with the queen in the first one, because that just got pretty ridiculous. Or even you had the button at the end of the first film where the O.J. Simpson's character is in the wheelchair and he falls off the edge of the stadium.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and that's actually another thing that they do. They keep the idea that Nordberg, O.J. Simpson's character Nordberg, is accident prone.
Right. He has more to do in this than in the first one, I think.
Yeah, I love that bit where he goes to put the tracer on that one guy's van, and it just leads to this great chase sequence where like he's trapped under the van being chased, but then he's trapped under the police car, and they're chasing their own signal, and then he gets trapped under a bus to Detroit, and it just keeps escalating to the point where when we see a bus drive through the background of a scene, we hear Nordberg screaming for help underneath the bus. And actually, that's one thing. Another thing that I liked is during that chase scene, a police car crashes into the zoo, and all the animals escape. And so, in all the following establishing shots, we see an escaped zoo animal run through the establishing shot. And then it comes full circle at the end of the movie, because when Robert Goulet's character thinks he's getting away scot free, he's then attacked by a lion, which kills him. And that I like. I like a running gag that has a really good juicy payoff like that.
And yet, well, I think you just said it perfectly early on, Thrasher. I mean, while it has a few scenes that work, it's just not as consistently funny as the first movie.
It does have a really good fight scene, though. When there's a great bit where Lisa Marie is in the shower,
an
assassin's been sent to take her out, and while she's in the shower, she's singing the song Memories, and the assassin hears it and is moved to tears, and then he joins in, and they start singing a duet.
That's a real nice slow build-up, because it takes its time, and you're not quite sure where it's going, and then
the fight scene is hilarious. I love that they fight, that Leslie Nielsen and the assassin fight each other with things in the bathroom. You know, they brush each other's teeth, they blow dry each other's hair.
Right.
They look at Jane in the shower.
Yep. Extensively. For longer than is necessary. Yeah, so I think this movie's okay. I do want to point out to our listeners, if you go to our website at sequelcast.com and you like what you hear in the show, feel free to donate via the PayPal link, because every little bit helps. And we also got links to the... you can rent the movies we're talking about as an Amazon digital rental. It's usually between $1.99 to $2.99, so if you want to watch the films we're talking about, that's a good way to do that and help us out. And you can also hear the Sequel Cast podcast on Stitcher Smart Radio. Get the app for your computer or phone at stitcher.com/sequelcast and all the Sequel Cast network shows, including the Sequel Cast, which is what you're listening to now, and other podcasts like Video Game Sequel Cast on video game franchises and Sequel Commentary and all that stuff. They'll be added as your favorites if you get Stitcher at stitcher.com/sequelcast.
Listen to us on Stitcher.
So back to our discussion.
Oh, no, something we didn't talk about in the first film, and I wish we had, is that something that runs through all these three films are during the opening credit sequence, it's all done from the POV of the roof of a squad car.
Right.
And, you know, we see that squad car running through the streets, kind of like in the introduction to the Untouchables, but as it progresses, the squad car goes through more in more bizarre situations that a squad car couldn't possibly do, which reaches a wonderful, absurd height when the squad car is like going through a tunnel and then like the tunnel gets all pink and fleshy and then parts and the tunnel has come out of a the squad car has come out of a pregnant woman to the horror of the attending doctor.
And that one part, it goes into a ladies' locker room. Now, do you remember if this sequence was as crazy in the first film or was it just the car driving like in the
show? Wasn't.
I
feel like it was a bit more. It was a bit crazier in this one, right. if only because the car goes through a woman's birth canal.
Is it the third one where it goes through the Death Star?
Yeah, the third one, which is probably the best of these opening sequences. Yeah, it goes. The squad car does the Death Star trench run.
Right. Pretty neat.
And then goes to Jurassic Park.
That's right. Yeah, you know, I have very little else to say about Naked Gun 2.5. I mean, I think the first film is good. I don't think it's great, but the second film is just okay. I would give it probably, at the time I saw this film, I liked it. And even after rewatching this on Twitter, I said I thought it was better than the first film. But the more I think about it, I remember very little of this film not too long after watching it.
Well, you know what I've heard from several people in regards to the Naked Gun films is that they liked them when they were kids and just don't know why they're funny as adults.
I understand why some of it's funny, but I just don't think it's as hilarious. Right? I guess you're right at that part because I would watch these over and over again as a kid. But I'm not sure what it is if I don't think the physical humor is as good. Certainly Leslie Nielsen and Priscilla Presley are very game in their performances. I mean, the main characters are good.
All the performances are great. I think the real flaw in this movie is that it's just not a parody of anything.
Yeah.
It's not a parody of a thriller. It's not a parody of an action movie. It's not a parody of a police procedural. It's not anything, and so it doesn't have a structure. It doesn't have a real structure to build these jokes around. And I think those are the best parodies, are the parodies where they take the structure or the style or the tropes of a particular type of movie and then build as many jokes as possible around that thing, but keeping the thing intact.
That's well said. But I would give this 2 out of 5 stars.
Yeah, I'm actually in complete agreement. I'm gonna give it 2. You know, The parts I liked, I could not stop laughing, but there were just too few of those parts.
Well, let's move on to pitch a sequel.
Do you know what? Actually, before yes. Do you know what? Strangely enough, we've already talked about the bomb, which probably the two bomb scenes probably made me laugh the hardest. But the other thing that just had me laughing long after the joke had finished is when Lisa Marie like kind of shifts her body, descends like a foot, and then holds up these giant shoes. I don't know why, but that just started. I just like could not stop laughing after I saw that.
What do you mean by Lisa Marie?
Or Jane?
Oh, Jane. Okay. Yeah, she does a lot of very understated work. There's also the sequence that spoofs Ghost as part of the romantic montage.
Oh, actually, yeah. And the sex scene was also another scene that was just wonderfully over the top, where Leslie Nielsen inexplicably has this really chiseled body, and like he like wraps his legs around her, and she's able to hold him up, and it's lots of great stuff in that scene.
Much like the romance scenes in the first one. I think some of the better stuff in the film. So, for my pitch a sequel, I was thinking about this, not that the plot really matters in the Naked Gun films as much as some of the other stuff we've talked about. I would have a story called the Little Naked Gun. And it would be about, even though he's in his old age, Frank has a baby with his new wife, Jane. And the baby comes out of the womb. The baby happens to be a super spy. Even though it doesn't speak English, it's really smart. It's kind of like everything that Frank Drebin wasn't. And so because of this in the police station, you know, they recognize what this baby can do because Frank takes the baby to work and the baby manages to solve all these crimes, these unsolved mysteries.
Is the baby played by Damon Wayans?
No, the baby be just an actual baby, but it's like he looks through the files and matches two pieces of paper and people are like, oh my, this is the missing link. Now we can find the killer. And just sort of does that thing. So they give the Frank Drebin's baby his own desk and promotes him, his son, who's a baby, promotes Frank Drebin's son to captain. And they demote Frank Drebin for not being good enough. So now Frank Drebin has to work under the shadow of his son, and his son is a baby, but happens to be a genius in his own police squad.
Well, mine will be Naked Gun 3 1/4, A Hard Day to Die Harder 2. Where, you know, in this one, you know, Jane has gotten a job at the Nakatomi Company and is working there her corporate work and Frank's police work have, you know, caused some tension in their relationship. But he's flying to the place where she works because in the tower they're going to have a huge Passover party, and he goes there to go to the Passover party. However, jewel thieves disguised as terrorists take over the building, and the whole thing is an elaborate Die Hard parody with Frank Drebin trying to get reunited in his wife. But the thing is going to be that Frank Drebin actually does not know that the building is under siege until like the final act of the movie. Up until then, it's just him kind of being bumbling and accident prone and accidentally defeating these armed criminals.
Hmm.
And it will be sort of a parody of Die Hard and really any other under siege facility type movie. This will, you know, will include, of course, Under Siege. It'll also include Assault on Precinct 13, that kind of thing. Do you have any sequel news to share with us?
I do have some sequel news, I guess, even though mega producer Jerry Bruckheimer, I don't think he has a deal as big with Disney as he used to. He's still trying to get a Pirates of the Caribbean 5 and a Beverly Hills Cop 4 off the ground.
Huh.
And the Pirates of the Caribbean stuff, first off, recently Johnny Depp said he's going to retire soon.
And so really?
And I don't know whether to take that seriously or not. You know, you get actors that say they're going to retire all the time. They keep on doing movies every few years. And that seems like a strange thing to me, but I guess if he's really going to retire, who knows? I'm sort of skeptical, but I don't really think we need a fifth Pirates of the Caribbean.
I don't think we need a second one.
Or a third or a fourth. Yeah, they made a lot of those. But I, you know, Beverly Hills Cop 4, that's been in the works on and off for a long time. They did a pilot for a Beverly Hills Cop TV show.
It did get to the pilot stage.
Yeah, they filmed a pilot.
Oh,
cool. It did not get picked up for whatever reason last year. So they're trying to do it as a movie, and I think with a different script and stuff. So we can see. I mean, like, Eddie Murphy does not act in movies very much anymore. I think the last big thing he was in was Tower Heist.
I wouldn't mind seeing him as Axel again. I guess, like, I feel like I would like to see Axel get a better final appearance than what we got in Beverly Hills Cop 3, which you can listen to our sequel commentary for.
Right, or even the first few episodes of the sequel cast are on the Beverly Hills Cop trilogy done many moons ago.
Yeah, actually, you know what I would like to see? I would like to see him retire to Beverly Hills only to get sucked into some sort of crime that he has to solve.
I mean, yeah, looks like here that the last thing he did was he was in a movie that came out that was delayed quite a few years called A Thousand Words.
Oh, yeah.
Drama that looked terrible from the trailer. I never saw the film. Maybe it's good. I have no idea. But
there's a couple of bad movie podcasts that have covered it, and the premise is interesting, but it just sounds like it was executed horribly.
Hmm. Oh, I mean, I think Eddie Murphy's really talented. I would like to see him return to Beverly Hills Cop, but we'll just see. Any sequel news for you, Thrasher?
Well, it's movie related. Apparently, with the release of Frozen on DVD, the desire for the merchandise has skyrocketed, and there just isn't enough of it. So there's a thriving industry of reselling Frozen merchandise on eBay and other online outlets.
Well, I'll put this to the test. I'm going to go to eBay.com right now and look up what's a piece of merchandise.
Let's look for the Elsa doll.
Is it ELSA? Is that how you do it?
ELSA. That's correct.
Right. So,
elongated last says anything.
Huh. I mean, yeah, it looks like... let me sort by most expensive. Yeah, some of the stuff, you're right. I think you have these limited edition dolls that people are trying to sell for several thousand bucks. A lot of, like, costumes that people are selling for a few hundred dollars. So... And I mean, Frozen is a legitimate big hit for some of these people aren't like here. Like these limited edition 17-inch dolls have 13 bids, and it's for $1,675 for Elsa and Anna as a set. So,
well, you know, I think so. Do you think Disney underestimated the appeal that Frozen was going to have?
I think so. I mean, it does make me
wonder...
Because
they're such a merchandising machine, normally.
They are. It makes me wonder how much kids buy dolls anymore when you have iPhones and iPads and all these other things, but...
The kids don't necessarily have those.
No, that's true. But Frozen is, you know, the biggest cartoon hit Disney has had since The Lion King, if we're not counting the Pixar stuff. This movie's made nearly $1 billion, if not more than that at this point. So, of course, the demand's going to skyrocket. I imagine they'll come out with other merchandise in the future, but they're just kind of caught with their pants down on this one. I do find it surprising, because this is Disney. It's not like, I don't know, like, it's not like Sony or some lesser-known animation company that did something that became a hit. But so I'm
merchandising.
But that is a pretty interesting bit of news.
Yeah, it just struck me. I stumbled across that today.
Hmm. Well, what you watching, Thrasher?
Oh, what am I watching? Well, for just the sheer pleasure of it, I've been watching the second season of the Comedy Bang Bang TV series.
That's a weird one.
Yes, but I adore it.
So I've listened to the podcast quite a bit, and I'm pleased to see that the TV show gets just as obscure and weird with its tone.
all while mocking the format of a talk show.
Right.
They did this really great sketch. We're supposed to be like a hidden camera thing called Scott Scares 'em, where, like, Scott would try to jump out and scare people disguised as a bush, but every time he scared someone, they would want to be in on the prank until, like, it's finally, like, a rotating cast of him and eight other people. That was a scene that like, wrung laughs out of a title card. I love when that can happen.
Yeah, that doesn't happen often here. One thing I was watching is an interesting series that just got on Netflix Watch instantly called The Writer's Room. Just the first season, but it stars Jim Rash, who's the bald principal in Community. And he's also a screenwriter himself. And it's just him talking to the writing staffs of different TV shows. He talks to the people that do Game of Thrones, like the sitcom New Girl, Dexter, and all these things. So, I mean, there's certainly a lot of spoilers there, but I like how minimalist it's just a bunch of writers in a room talking to each other.
Actually, speaking of Community, did you see the G.I. Joe episode of Community?
I did.
I think it really speaks to their format-bending ability that they were able to do. They were able to do an episode in the style of a shitty 1980s cartoon while still lovingly portraying how shitty it was and having some of the original cast.
Yeah, I mean, they got that style right. It must have been a... You know, they did a claymation episode, I think, in the... maybe the first season, and then you had a episode that looked like a Nintendo game.
Yeah, and there's an episode with all puppets.
In season 3, right, an all-puppet episode from season 4, so with this season 5 right now. Yeah, it's pretty amazing they're able to get the rights to use all the G.I. Joe characters.
Well, I mean, it's free advertising for Hasbro.
It is, and I enjoyed the Cobra Commander jokes were good. I think the G.I. Joe redesigns of the Community characters is pretty funny. And I really like how they even make fun of the live-action toy commercials.
Oh, the commercials were spot on.
I think that might have been my favorite part of the episode. So, I think Community's good this season. I don't think it really got terrible. I mean, every show is a bit hit or miss. So we'll see if he gets another season after this one. It's one of those shows that the ratings don't do that well, but then it seems to sell enough DVDs and stuff for them to keep on bringing it back, I guess.
I have a hunch they are going to get those 6 seasons. Whether or not they get a movie, who knows.
Yeah.
That would be great if they actually did pull that off.
I don't even know what you do. I mean, I think that the show has lost something with Chevy Chase's Pierce not on the show, but more so that Donald Glover is not on the show anymore as Troy, I think.
Yeah.
Took a lot out of it. He was real. I mean, Troy and Abed, not having Troy there, it just makes it feel a bit empty.
Although I am glad that they didn't just have him disappear, that they kind of weaned us off of Troy.
They did, and that episode where Troy left I thought was very funny. And I'm thinking maybe they'll bring him back for a cameo.
I suspect I'm sure he's going to show up on the season finale.
The season finale is a 2-part, and they just aired the first part. I think it's only a 12 or 13-episode season.
It's a short season, but I feel like they've all been short seasons since the 3rd.
Yeah, I guess so. I'm trying to recall. I've seen every episode of the show, so... Well, I think that's... all the what you're watching I've been doing, unless there's another one you want to bring up, Thrasher.
Just because it was fun, I rewatched the classic Doctor Who episode, The Sontaran Experiment.
So who was the doctor in that one?
That's a Tom Baker episode.
I see. When does the new Doctor Who start?
I don't know. I know there's going to be there's always a Christmas special, so I'm sure they're going to do a Christmas special before the full series gets underway.
And did rewatching this episode live up to your memories?
It did, although I didn't remember it being so short. It's you know, back when they were still using the serial format, and it's only 2 episodes long.
Hmm.
For some reason, I remember it being much longer.
Why is it so short? Was it because of the strike or?
No, there was no strike. For once, it wasn't because of a strike at the BBC. originally, it takes place immediately after the serial, The Ark in Space, and originally, The Ark in Space was supposed to be much longer, but for various production reasons, they decided to break it up. And so the whole plot line involving scouts from a human empire was removed from the Ark in Space and then rolled over into this Sontaran episode. And they had a Sontaran because they needed a good villain. But because it's only two episodes long, it's a very tight story. There's very little filler in it.
I'll have to check the one out. I'm so behind on that show.
And it's 50 years behind.
Yeah, no, it's been on.
There's a lot of ground to cover.
Oh, that is one thing I have been enjoying, I guess, for me to do one last thing. So sometimes lately at work, I've had the chance to listen to the radio, or more specifically BBC stuff through the website. And there's a show called Desert Island Discs.
Oh, yeah.
It's been around since the 40s, and I was listening to an old episode from 1977 with Alec Guinness on. And this was after he did Star Wars, but before it came out in England. And they're asking him about Star Wars, and they asked him, what does he do in the movie? And he says, I play this sort of wizard person. I'm not sure if the movie takes place in the past or in the future, but I think it's what you call a good time at the movies. And he seems sort of bemused about it, which is sort of funny.
Well, when he did Star Wars, I'm sure he had no idea what he was getting into. I'm sure no one involved with Star Wars had any idea what they were getting into.
No, I think that it was such a huge success, surprised everyone. I mean, I just finished reading a Making of Return of the Jedi book that came out a year or two ago, where they've been doing one of these every few years for the, 30th anniversary or something.
Hmm.
And it goes into such crazy detail of what the original storyline was supposed to be. That kind of made me disappointed more in the film.
What did that original storyline include?
It would have been instead of like a attack on another Death Star, they would have found an Imperial homeworld full of tons of Death Stars under construction.
Mm.
And there would have been a big sort of air to ground battle and everything, but it just would have been proven to be too expensive, I think, at the time.
Well, actually, that explains a piece of uncovered production artwork I saw last year, which had a literal fleet of Death Stars in it.
Right. Yeah. That's what it's referring to. I believe that's in this book as well.
That is fascinating.
So, but I'd recommend any of those Making of Star Wars, Empire Strikes Back, and Return of the Jedi books, if you can get them from the library. If you buy the books, I mean, they're good, but I think they're like $50 a piece. They're pretty expensive.
They're for the collector.
They're absolutely for the collector. It's like coffee table size. A lot of good photos in there. So I think they're worth your time if you like Star Wars, like I do. And we actually covered those films a while back on the SequelCast. Check those out, sequelcast.com. So we have a Paul Goebel Memorial Mashup. Why don't you explain that to our listeners?
Yes, well, what I do, this was bequeathed to us by the king of TV, Paul Goebel himself. And what I do is I take two different impressions, which I may not be any good at, combine them into one impression, and Matt and our guests have to figure out what that impression is. And the name of that impression will be a combination of the names of the two people involved. So are you ready to go?
I am.
What is best in life? To crush your enemies, to see them driven before you, to hear the lamentations of their women, or, failing that, to hide out in an attic for several years and keep down every thought you have in a diary, especially the thoughts you have about your blossoming womanhood.
Okay. Wait, So I know some of that is Conan the Barbarian. Some of that you're referring to, I believe, the Diary of Anne Frank.
So what would the mashup be?
That's the thing. I can't remember the author of the Conan stories.
You're thinking too hard.
I'm thinking too hard.
Yeah.
But you can't do like like Anne Frank Schwarzenegger. That doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't.
Conan the diary writer doesn't make sense. I give up. I can recognize, as I so often do in this game, I recognize the two pieces, but not how it comes together.
You have the pieces, just putting them together right. It's Conan the Barbarian Frank.
Ah, shit.
Although, nice. I would have also accepted Conan Frank.
Ah, funny, okay. Yeesh. That's,
So that was a mashup, ladies and gentlemen.
What a mashup it was. Speaking of the Conan, that is something I did watch as one last thing. There's a documentary called, I think it's just called Milius. Let me look it up. About the director John Milius, who did the first Conan the Barbarian movie. He also was a writer in the first two Dirty Harry films.
Oh, yes.
And it's a pretty good collection of interviews, and he has a lot of crazy stories of he would always carry guns around and stuff and threaten executives if they didn't do what he said. And it's called Milius, came out in 2013, but I think it's pretty good, pretty interesting. If you like kind of stories from Hollywood from the 70s, it kind of goes through it kind of goes through his career. They talk to people like Steven Spielberg and George Lucas and Richard Dreyfuss and all these people he worked with. In fact, he actually did, Milius wrote the monologue from Jaws about the Indianapolis, I believe?
Oh, yes.
But what Milius turned in was a 10-page monologue, and then on set they cut it down to 5 pages. So, very, very... So I'd recommend Milius as a documentary. So tune in next time to SequelCast, where we'll talk about the last film in the Naked Gun series, Naked Gun 33 and a Third, The Final Insult. You can follow me on Twitter at SequelCast, and if you're in Wilsonville, Oregon, I host a pub quiz for Geeks Who Drink at the Ram, Tuesdays, 8 to 10 p.m.
And I'm going to be nowhere in particular, but you can follow me on Twitter, at InternetMayor.
No more conventions coming up?
Not until next month. Then I'll be at Comic-Palooza in Austin, Texas.
I see.
Or Houston, Texas. I forget which. It's one of those. So, this is Thrasher.
And this is Matt.
Saying... There are no memorable quotes in this movie.
No, I was trying to think of one. The sequel cast is a Hipster Goblin production.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.